the sofa and listen. With the roses of the May, I will kiss your lips and say, Oh, my darling, mine alone, you have never older grown. Daddy is in the doorway. The song ends.
That was lovely, Mercedes.
Thank you, Daddy.
Play something else, my dear, he says, crossing the room to sit in the wing-back chair.
Play Oh, My Darling Clementine, Lily requests.
What in the name of time have you done to your face?
We did a minstrel show in the cellar, Daddy, says Lily.
James looks at Francis. Francis just looks back. Daddy smiles at Lily. Come here, you wee scallywag.
Lily jumps into Daddy's lap.
Go on and play, Mercedes.
Mercedes plays and Daddy and Lily sing, cuddled together in the wing-back chair. Francis watches them as though transfixed. Lily belts out her favorite part. Herring boxes without topses, shoes they were for Clementine. Lily always wonders what happened to Clementine, the minor 49er's daughter, lost and gone forever, where? The song comes to an end. Daddy gently shifts Lily off his knees and rises.
Tell you what, Mercedes, I'm going to fix that C-sharp right this minute.
Oh, thank goodness, Daddy, it's so annoying. Mercedes is a lady. She is able to chat with Daddy like that. Francis marvels.
James opens the piano lid and looks in. Give it a tap, Mercedes.
She does.
Nothing to it, says James. I'll get my tools.
Then he sees the photograph. The laughing, leaning forward girl with the halo of hurry. Daddy! The house is behind her, and you can just see Materia in the kitchen window waving. Something bright in her hand, flashed against the lens. James can hear Kathleen laughing at him, totally unafraid, nothing to be afraid of. Not like now in this room. Now is the dim past. Then was the shining present. He hears her laugh. He hears the water trickling in the creek, and flash goes Materia's waving hand. Although her face is barely visible. Kathleen is 14. You think you're safe until you see a picture like that. And then you know you'll always be a slave to the present because the present is more powerful than the past, no matter how long ago the present happened. If only he hadn't let her go so far from home. If only he had gone with her to New York. None of it would have happened. She would never have got pregnant. Not that I regret Lily. Lily is my consolation, but my first girl. She'd be with me now. Oh, my darling. The breath assaults James's lungs, and he comes out of the black and white picture back into the room of living color and looks around. My good daughter, my bad daughter, and my dear daughter's daughter, in blackface. That isn't even worth getting riled about, although riled is what Francis tries to get me with something like that.
What's this doing here?
He asks Mercedes softly. There are no pictures of Kathleen anywhere. Not a spinning wheel in the kingdom, so to speak. And then you prick your finger.
Mercedes answers,
I'm sorry, Daddy.
Francis stares at James.
I did it. Mercedes swivels on the piano stool. She wants to say to Francis, No, it will go much harder with you. You don't have to atone for the ruin of my silly possessions by taking the blame for this. But Francis deliberately digs her own grave. Kathleen was my sister, and I'd like to see her now and then.
James is getting whiter. The blue part of his eyes is heating up.
Francis stokes him. Why can't we, anyhow? Was something wrong with her? Was she a lunatic or something?
Casual, insolent tone.
Mercedes can't find her voice. It's autumn in her mouth, and all her tongue can do is rustle. Lily doesn't like it when Daddy looks at Frances like that. It's not Daddy anymore. Not her Daddy.
Was she a slut? Frances, in a helpful tone of voice.
Ah, that's just right. Look at him, all lit up like an Easter candle. James says quietly to Frances, "Come with me."
Frances shrugs and gets up, nonchalant, grinning at Mercedes. Mercedes covers her face with her hands.
James says to Mercedes, "Take your sister out for a while."
"Come on, Lily."
Lily's forehead has the bump in it, but she obeys. Frances saunters across the room toward James, who finally snaps at the sight of her slouching toward him, grabs the back of her neck, and flings her through the doorway. Mercedes hustles Lily out the front door.
"Where are we going, Mercedes?"
"Out."
"I broke your beautiful thing."
"I don't care, Lily. Just walk, please." Down the porch steps.
"Frances glued it, but I broke it, and I tore up your book, too. I didn't mean to."
"They're just things, Lily. They don't matter." Lily is having a hard time keeping up, but she has no choice. Mercedes has her by the wrist.
"I'm sorry, Mercedes."
No answer.
"Mercedes."
"That's enough, Lily." They walk, drag through town until they come to the cliff above the shore. Mercedes stands staring out at the gray sea. Lily sits with her legs dangling over the edge.
"How come I never saw that picture?"
"You know perfectly well. Because Daddy doesn't like to dwell on Kathleen. It grieves him."
"Did you hide it?"
"Yes. In the book you destroyed. That's how it came to be out in the open."
"That's the book Frances likes to read. That's how come I accidentally wrecked it. Because Frances accidentally made me."
"Well, then, she has you to thank for whatever Daddy gives her."
"How come you put the picture on the piano, Mercedes?"
Mercedes freezes.
"How come, indeed?
Surely not on purpose." Mercedes turns her head slowly and looks at Lily. She sees her falling over the cliff to the rocks below. The only thing that would not break would be her withered leg and its steel brace. Without looking at Mercedes, Lily rises and wanders back to the shore road. She turns to see if Mercedes is coming, but Mercedes is kneeling at the precipice, facing the ocean.
"Mercedes,"
she calls.
"Don't fall, Mercedes."
Mercedes makes the sign of the cross and gets up. God will forgive her. She has made him a promise. On Water Street, the outside walls of the shed thump now and then like a bass drum with a foot pedal at work inside it, keeping the beat. In the shed, the performance has begun. The upbeat grabs her neck till she's on point. The downbeat thrusts her back against the wall. Two eighth notes of head on wood. Knuckles clatter incidentally. In the half-note rest, he lights up her pale face with the blue wicks of his eyes, and the lyrics kick in con spirito. "What right have you? You have no right. No right to even speak her name. Who's the slut? Tell me who's the slut." The next two bars are like the first. Then we're into the second movement. Swing your partner from the wall into the workbench, which catches her in the small of the back. Grace snowed into stumble because she bounces, being young. Staccato across the face. Then she expands her percussive range and becomes a silent tambourine. Frances gets through this part by pretending to herself that she's actually Raggedy Lily of the Valley, which makes her laugh and provokes his second verse. "I don't want to hear you speak her name." Accidental note to the nose resolves into big major chord, "Do you understand me?" We've gone all stately. It's whole notes from here on in. She flies against another wall, and he follows her trajectory.
taking his time now because we're working up to the finale. One more clash of timbers and tissues, and it's finally opera. I'll cut the tongue right out of your head. She sticks her tongue out at him and tastes blood. Cue finale to the gut. Frances falls over till she's on the floor. Modern dancer. The first thing Mercedes did was bring Frances Spanish influenza and the rest of her dear children, arranging them lovingly on her bed. Even though Frances didn't register their arrival, Mercedes knew their presence would comfort her. Then she got a basin and a cloth and cleaned Frances's face. The swelling makes Frances look even younger than 16, especially with all her dolls around her. She speaks finally, her words a little thick. "Where's Trixie?" "It's okay. Trixie's fine." Frances hurts all over, which makes her feel restful. It's a lovely feeling that she hardly ever gets. Mercedes squeezes out the cloth.
"You shouldn't make him angry like that."
"He deserves it."
"You're the one who gets hurt."
Frances swallows carefully. "I'm sorry about your things."
"It's all right, Frances. You didn't have to take the blame for the photograph."
"Yes, I did."
"Why?"
"It's the way it is, Mercedes. You can't change the way it is."
"I don't agree. That doesn't make any sense. He shouldn't beat you for something I did."
"Well, he wouldn't beat you."
"Well, good then. No one need have got beaten."
"Yes, someone did need to. Besides, it lets me get back at him."
"For what?"
Frances looks at Mercedes and smiles slightly, which makes the fresh seam in her lower lip gleam. "For the thing you don't know. And what you don't know won't hurt you."
Mercedes says nothing.
Frances reaches for diphtheria rose, hugs her, and closes her eyes. Mercedes has told Daddy that the picture has been burned to nothing on the stove. But it's a lie. She can't part with it. She leaves Frances sleeping, but before going to the coal cellar to keep her promise to God, she climbs the attic stairs for the second time today. Mercedes knows that Daddy never looks in the hope chest. The photo will be perfectly safe there. When the house is quiet, Trixie lopes up the stairs into Frances and Lily's room and silently leaps onto the bed. She snuggles down amongst the dolls in the crook of Frances's arm. She watches Frances sleep for a while. Then she lays her head upon the pillow, extends her paw, and rests it against Frances's forehead. Neither of them moves till morning. We are the dead. All by myself I have to go, with none to tell me what to do, all alone beside the streams and up the mountain sides of dreams. Robert Louis Stevenson, The Land of Nod. An opening in the earth a third of the way up a steep slope of limestone, thin grass and scant soil. Crazy pine trees grow parallel to the slant here and there. An archway in the earth, no inscription. An abandoned bootleg mine, a drift mine, the type that cuts into a hill face and burrows horizontally. Every time people find an old mine around here, they think they've found the old French mine. There's no treasure associated with the old French mine. It just happened to be the first hole excavated for the purpose of extracting buried sunshine. This is the sort of thing that becomes important when you don't have cathedrals. "It's the old French mine," says Francis. "No one else knows it's here." Francis and Lily stand at the base of the hill looking up. Behind them are the woods, where Frances has just blazed a trail in the pine trees with the kitchen scissors. She brings a hand up to shade her eyes in the manner of a French Foreign Legion commander. the overcast Cape Breton sky notwithstanding. Her left eye socket has healed to pale yellow, but her right one is still a pouchy mauve, wounds sustained in my last hand-to-hand bout with the Algerians, mon Dieu. Frances cuts what she intends to be a plucky figure in her blue girl-guide uniform. Her neckerchief is neatly knotted, her beret tweaked at regulation angle, her leather pouch buckled to her belt. The only things missing are badges. She has yet to earn one. She has yet to attend a second guide meeting. Lily is in her brownie uniform. Daddy has finally let her join because she hasn't had so much as a cold for a long, long time. Frances was supposed to take her to her first brownie pack meeting this afternoon, but brought her here instead. They walked all the way, and it's miles. Frances told Lily she would earn her hiking badge. There are dead men in there, Lily, and diamonds.
Like in Aladdin.
That's right.
Let's go home now, Frances.
We're going in.
Frances reaches for Lily's hand, but Lily backs away.
Come on, Lily. Just for a little visit.
No, Frances. There's dead people in there.
Dead people are completely harmless.
What about ghosts?
There's no such thing.
Then who are we visiting if they're all dead?
Ambrose.
Lily searches Francis's face. Ambrose is dead.
No, he isn't.
He is so. He drowned, you said.
Yes, he drowned. But he isn't dead, Lily. He's an angel, remember? He became an angel. It happens. And he's in there. That's where he lives. I think it's time you met him.
No.
Come on. I'll be with you.
No.
Frances seizes Lily's arm and pulls her along, like trying to get a dog upstairs. You'll earn a badge for this, Lily.
I don't want to go in there, Frances.
Lily's voice is shaking with fear. You can't get your wings and fly up to guides if you don't earn your guardian angel badge.
Frances starts laughing, and Lily knows it's going to get bad.
They've started up the slope, Lily twisting in Frances's grasp. Frances grapples her into a sack of potatoes over her shoulder. Lily ceases to struggle. They climb up into the mouth of the mine. They enter. There's nothing much to see. A few rotting ribs of wood and pit props, a rusted shovel. Frances carries Lily forward. It gets darker. The air is musty. They follow a bend in the tunnel and lose sight of the light at the entrance. Frances walks on slowly into the dank and shapeless dark. Lily asks quietly,
"What if we get lost?"
"We won't. Ambrose will find us." Lily whimpers. "He loves you, Lily. Don't be afraid."
"I want to go home."
"We are home. We're in his home." Frances stops and puts Lily down. Her fingers feel for the snap on her girl guide pouch. She withdraws a cigarette and strikes a match against her belt buckle. The tongue of fire illuminates. A pool of still water inches from their feet. Dear God, how deep is it? And over there, against the wall, Lily screams. Frances lights her cigarette and blows out the match.
There's someone here, Frances.
Lily's voice is shaking.
He's standing over there, on the other side of the water.
Frances takes a big puff. What's he look like?
He's got overalls on, and a pick, and a peaked cap.
Is there a lamp on his cap?
Yes, the teapot kind.
He must have been dead quite a while. Frances blows invisible smoke rings.
Frances!
Lily's fear is spilling over. It's not Ambrose, Lily. It's a dead miner. Frances lights another match. The pool, the seeping wall.
Lily cries out again as the flame disappears.
It's not a miner, Francis.
What is it?
He's got a mask on.
A Halloween mask?
A gas mask. He's got a rifle with a bayonet on the end.
A dead soldier. Francis lights another match. The black water, stones, and earthen walls.
He's gone, says Lily.
Ambrose took him away because he knew you were scared. Baby. Brownie baby.
Ambrose isn't here.
Yes, he is.
Where?
Francis drops her cigarette and it sizzles against the unseen pool. In there. Lily looks down, dizzy from the dark.
Angels live in heaven.
They live wherever the hell they want.
I'm telling. You smoked and swore.
Go ahead and tattle.
Ambrose and I will still look after you no matter what. There's no such thing as Ambrose.
At night, he dives down in this pool and swims in an underground river till it comes out at the surface and turns into our creek. He takes a breath and swims in the shallow water, long and white, all the way till he gets to our place. Then he climbs out over the top of the bank and slowly walks, dripping across our yard, and opens the kitchen door. He walks past the oven. He walks into the hall, past the front room. He walks up the stairs without a sound and past the attic door. He comes into the room where you're asleep. He stands at the foot of the bed and looks down at you. He has red hair. And then he leaves. But he can't swim back. He has to move the rock in the garden and go down a tunnel that's too small for him now, until he gets to the sad and lonely mine. He walks for miles in his bare feet past all the quiet soldiers and miners resting against the walls. And every time he makes the journey back to the pool, his heart breaks. So you see how much he loves you, Lily, to make such a trip night after night. Silence. Lily pees her pants. Francis's footsteps trot away and around the bend until Lily can't hear them anymore. Her brownie stockings are soaked. She passes out. When Francis doesn't hear Lily cry or holler, she runs back through the darkness and lights another match. Oh my God! Lily! But Lily lies motionless. Dead of a heart attack at 10. It could happen.
Lily!
Francis shakes her, splashes water on her face, and she wakes up. Francis piggybacks her out of the mine and slides halfway down the hill in stones and dirt. When they get to the bottom, she props Lily against a mossy tree and catches her breath, hands on her knees. Lily opens her eyes.
Francis, I peed.
That's okay. We'll go straight home and change. Come on. Lily stays sitting.
Francis, what if Ambrose is the devil?
He's not the devil. I know who the devil is, and it isn't Ambrose.
Who's the devil?
Francis crouches down as if she were talking to Trixie. That's something I'll never tell you, Lily, no matter how old you get to be, because the devil is shy. It makes him angry when someone recognizes him. So once they do, the devil gets after them. And I don't want the devil to get after you.
Is the devil after you?
Yes.
Jesus can beat the devil.
If God wants.
God is against the devil.
God made the devil.
Why?
For fun.
No, to test us.
If you know, why are you asking me?
Daddy says there's no such thing as a devil. It's just an idea.
The devil lives with us.
No, he doesn't.
You see the devil every day. The devil hugs you and eats right next to you.
Daddy's not the devil.
I never said he was.
Francis
has got a dry look, tinder in the eye. Her voice is a stack of hay heating up at the center, her mouth a stitched line. I'm the devil.
This is the moment Lily stops being afraid of anything Francis could ever say or do again. Stops being afraid of anything at all. She reaches out and takes Francis's hand. The white hand that always smells of small wild flowers, lily of the valley. The hand that has always done up Lily's buttons and laces and produced wondrous objects. She holds Francis's hand and tells her, "It's okay, Francis." Francis's bruised face crumples, and her forehead drops to her knees, knocking her girl guide beret askew. Her stick arms encircle her legs, and she cries. Lily strokes the sinewy back, while Francis mumbles something over and over. Years later, Francis remembers what she was saying. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Lily. I'm sorry." But memory plays tricks. Memory is another word for story, and nothing is more unreliable. The First Miracle. My own soul cries out in anguish. It thirsts so much for purification and cleansing. Even while I sleep, my soul groans for complete surrender to Jesus. Ah, my Savior, my heart bleeds with pain and love. Oh, Jesus, you know it, my Jesus. The Secrets of Purgatory, author unknown. While Francis and Lily were at the old French mine, Mercedes was home in the coal cellar, keeping her promise to God. "Through my fault, through my fault, through my most grievous fault." Penance has not only eased her soul, it has been the occasion for Our Lady to put the idea into Mercedes' mind of a Lord's Fund for Lily. "Why didn't I think of it before?" But Mercedes knows the answer. She wasn't worthy to receive the inspiration until she acknowledged her sins and humbly begged God's forgiveness. Naturally, Mercedes has made a full confession. "Father, forgive me, for I have sinned. I wished my lame sister dead of a fall. I grieved my poor father. I allowed my favorite sister to suffer for my sin. I have a favorite sister." She has been assigned a standard penance of prayers, but she has devised an additional private penance here in the cellar. Although she has told no one of her penance, she has told Daddy and Francis about the Lord's Fund so that they may contribute, and she has told Lily so that Lily may have hope. There is nearly $2 in the cocoa tin already, and it's only been a week. At this rate, Lily will be able to go to Lourdes when she's 14. That's a good age for a cure. The brink of womanhood. Think how perfectly lovely Lily would be without her affliction. Mercedes rises, takes off the white shift, and hides it behind the furnace. She stands naked for a moment in the darkness and says a prayer of thanks to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. "Most blessed Virgin, merciful Mother, Virgin most powerful, seat of wisdom, tower of ivory, mystical rose, queen of the apostles, martyrs, and all the saints, Mother undefiled, pray for us. White rose of purity, winsome one, the daintiest jewel that God hath ever made, great casket of mysteries, princess fair, that death may be but a prelude to thy kiss. Amen." Then she gets dressed and goes upstairs to wash her tongue before everyone gets home. She has set the table for supper by the time Lily and Francis arrive rather late from brownies and guides. Lily goes straight up to the bathroom to launder her uniform and woolen stockings for a cleanliness badge. Francis goes straight to bed to avoid the meal. No one has invented a badge for that yet. Mercedes tells Daddy that Francis is indisposed, knowing he will not inquire further. Lies like that are not a sin, they are a sacrifice. Mercedes goes upstairs to get Lily. Lily is kneeling barefoot at the tub, which is how Mercedes notices that the wound on her left heel has reopened. That's not good. It's 2 weeks now since Armistice Day. Mercedes wrings out Lily's brownie uniform and soaks the bad foot in warm salt water. We'll have the doctor look at it tomorrow. Lily has noticed something different about Mercedes lately. For example, now her movements, they've gone glidey. Mercedes gets a clean dressing from the cabinet. She binds the wound gently and efficiently, not too tight this time. So why does Lily feel frightened as she watches the white cloth go round and round and round her little foot? There. Thank you, Mercedes. Mercedes smiles at Lily with the peace that penance brings. Lily makes her mouth stretch east and west simultaneously. And again, she feels a little scared, because Mercedes' smile is the kind of smile you figure must be meant for the person standing behind you. But behind you is the wall. They have sardines on toast for supper, since no one is very hungry tonight. When Lily crawls into bed, Francis is already asleep. And soon, so is Lily. It's Ambrose, standing at the foot of her bed, looking down at her the way he does. Lily is in that place again between the lines. This time she looks at him carefully, his wide green eyes, wincing even in this dim light, high, smooth forehead with the hint of a bump, his pale body, green shadows drowned beneath his skin, ivory belly, strange soft segments nestled between his thighs, hairless but for his head of fine-spun angel orange. Lily asks him, "Who are you?" She is prepared for the flood, but he does not open his mouth. Instead, he turns his palms to her. They are blank. She asks him again, "Who are you?" He opens his mouth, and the water pours out. But Lily stays in the in-between place and does not make a sound until she and the bed and Francis sleeping next to her are soaked. It's not so bad. The water is warm, having been inside him. When all the water is out of him, he is still looking, looking, his empty palms facing her. She asks for the third time, "Who are you?" Ambrose speaks his first words. He has a dark voice because he lives in a dark place. "I am no man."
"Don't be afraid, Ambrose. Don't be afraid. We love you,"
Ambrose says. "Hello."
"Hello," says Lily. "Hello, little boy. Hello."
Lily wakes up because Mercedes is sponging her head.
She's waking up. "Ambrose," says Lily. "She's delirious."
Mercedes' voice feels like surgery on Lily's skin.
"Who took my skin?"
"Soaked with fever." Lily buries her face in her drenched pillow because the light is an eye operation.
"The light is off, Lily. See? There's no light on."
Daddy has arrived with the doctor. It's a good sign that Lily's fever has broken, unless her temperature goes back up. Gangrene. Somewhere in the scalpel light, Lily hears him talking to Daddy and her sisters.
"You did the right thing, Mercedes."
They'll have to keep an eye on her for the rest of the night. If her temp goes up. If it goes up. They go out into the hall. Lily can't hear them anymore, except that Mercedes cries out something. Then Francis comes back in and sings songs to Lily. Nice ones. Beautiful sad ones in minor keys. Long story songs that our ancestors sang on the boats coming over in other languages. That was midnight. At 3:30 a.m., Lily wakes up. There's a bright moon glazing the window. On either side, Francis and Mercedes are slumped in chairs under bedsheets, lit like snowdrifts shadowed blue. It's Christmas Eve. The shepherds have fallen asleep beneath their flocks of snow.
Lily sits up in bed. Her skin is no longer sore. She feels cool and calm, a midnight clear.
She walks between the snowdrifts and their deep sleepers to the window, because she has been invited. Oh, it's not the moon at all. There is no moon tonight. The light is coming from the creek. Ambrose is in the creek. He is leaning out to wave, his left arm above his head, his right arm stretched along the lip of earth. His lower body is concealed by the embankment. He looks like a merman waving to Lily in the slow, wide lullaby of the ocean.
Hello?
His skin has changed from white to amber, and the glow has wakened Lily from her bed of fire into soothing rose milk.
She puts a hand to the window.
Hello?
Ambrose is the drowned sun. He is the buried sunshine. He's saying, "Come, Lily, come, my sister, and I will heal you. A garden locked, a fountain sealed, many waters cannot quench me."
He says, "The spring in my garden pours down from Lebanon. Come to me, and I will give you rest."
And Lily says, "Yes."
She is asleep, but her heart is wakeful.
"Yes, I'm coming, Ambrose. Wait for me, dear brother. I am coming."
Lily leaves the snow sleepers by the window and walks down the stairs, through the kitchen, out the back door, and over the coal clinks in the backyard in her bare feet. She shouldn't be able to walk at all with her wounded heel, but there's no pain. Just the glow of Ambrose waiting for her in the creek. Her big baby brother. He opens his arms. She goes to him. He picks her up in her white nightgown and cradles her, her head resting in the crook of his left shoulder, his right arm encircling her body. She has never felt so warm and peaceful.
"Are my eyes open or closed?"
It doesn't matter. There is almost no sensory change between the air and the water. It takes her a moment to realize why she feels lighter now, and even more tenderly embraced. It takes the sight of her own hair fanning out from her head, and the thickening of the soft orange light to let her know that now she is under water, her cheek resting against his breast, her body curved around its first companion.
"I would take you to my mother's house, to the room of she who conceived me."
Lily has never got used to being alone. They turn in the water and turn again. Then Ambrose lifts her above the surface once more, and the creek rains down from her. He lays her gently on the bank, and her heart breaks. Her tears begin to flow because he is leaving.
"Don't go!"
He sinks into the water on his back. "Take me with you!" His body turns white again and shimmers into segments until all the pieces disappear. Lily lies face down at right angles to the creek, her head hanging over the edge, arms outstretched toward the spot where she last saw her brother. That's how Mercedes finds her at 5 a.m. in the first snowfall of the season. Mercedes blamed herself for the fever that was consuming Lily and might result in the loss of her leg or worse. That was why she went straight to the coal cellar after the doctor's visit. While Frances sang to Lily in the dark, Mercedes was naked under burlap, kneeling by the furnace, offering up her sacrifice to God. She cups the lump of coal in both hands, elevates it, and bows her head.
"Through my fault."
When she did this last week, she was serene, a foolish smile on her lips. This time, however, she weeps hot tears. This time, she is truly penitent. That was the problem the first time. Pride.
She was proud of herself for staging her penance in the cellar, for establishing the Lord's cocoa tin. She was pleased with herself as she bathed and bandaged Lily's foot with an expertise she thought surpassed that of the nurses at New Waterford General. Her piety was pride in the devil's guise, her penitence nothing but a fresh occasion of sin. Oh, how often must we learn the same lesson! God reacted swiftly and smote Lily. "Through my fault." Mercedes can barely get out the words. And as she takes the first bite of coal, chews and swallows, sorrow overwhelms her. She is so bitterly aware of how she has hurt God, and of how God, in his infinite mercy, has given her this second chance of which she is not worthy. "Through my most grievous fault." She takes another bite of coal. When Mercedes finished in the cellar, she rose shakily, changed back into her nightgown and went upstairs, where she washed the soot, snot, and tears off her face, scrubbed her tongue as best she could, got her opal rosary, and went in to keep watch on Lily. She fell asleep in a chair opposite Francis. When she awoke for no reason at 4:55 a.m., Lily was gone. Mercedes obeyed an ancient reflex to look out the window and down at the creek. The following evening, when Lily opens her eyes and looks into Mercedes' praying mouth, it occurs to her for the first time that she must be dreaming, because why has Mercedes got a black tongue? Lily slept through extreme unction, and she slept through the doctor saying no point even amputating the leg now. And was she in the habit of sleepwalking? She slept through Daddy laying his head on her chest and sobbing. She slept through Francis bribing and threatening God. "You bastard! I'll be good, okay? Just don't murder her, and I won't smoke anymore, okay? I won't swear, I won't make my fucking maniac father mad anymore, and I'll say the rosary 10 times a day and be a goddamn nun, okay? Amen." But what woke Lily were Mercedes' whispered prayers. Lily asks, "How come you've got a black tongue, Mercedes?" Mercedes cries, "Oh, thank God! Daddy! Daddy!" He swerves into the room, "Oh, thank God!" and kneels next to Mercedes at Lily's bedside. Lily says, "I'm hungry." Daddy and Mercedes laugh and hug each other and thank God again. Francis loiters in the doorway and tells God, "There's no way I'm being a nun out of this." Mercedes is careful to avoid the slightest idea of Lily's miraculous cure being at all connected with her own acts of contrition in the cellar. That would be inviting more of God's infinite mercy. So she is relieved when Lily offers an explanation of her own. "Ambrose cured me. He washed me in the creek." "Who's Ambrose?" "He's my guardian angel." Mercedes tells the priest. He nods, but tells her that it is of the greatest importance not to be premature about these things. Rome requires more than an isolated event, while the laity require almost nothing to make a shrine out of a creek and a saint out of a 10-year-old girl. Best to keep quiet and watch for signs. So Mercedes does. She tries not to dwell on the signs that are suddenly evident in retrospect. Lily's shriveled leg, saints are often stricken in childhood, her pretty face, the mirror of her soul, the tragic circumstances of her birth, poor motherless child. Just imagine if Lily were revealed to have a healing power, or if she were the instrument of a posthumous miracle by Bernadette at Lourdes. Mercedes does her best to chasten these thoughts, knowing from bitter experience how the devil masquerades. He is a mocker and a mimic, a dealer in reflections and parallel lines. Just look at all the supposed saints the church had to burn a few centuries ago. Saints and satanic vessels tend to start out the same way. You have to watch closely to see which force will rush in to claim the highly conductive soul of the candidate, for it is bound to be one or the other.
Mercedes knows that if the devil catches the slightest whiff of ambition on her part, he will come and get Lily. But since Mercedes can't help but want Lily to be revealed as a saint, she tries to want it only for Daddy's sake, the ultimate vindication. Francis doesn't need to tell Lily any more Ambrose stories after this, because he has become Lily's story. Francis has finally succeeded in giving him to her. Lily is okay. For now, Francis can get on with other things. Her life. She raids the Lord's tin. She puts on her girl guide uniform and stows away in the Hupmobile. Once at James's still, she slides out and hides in the bushes till Leo Taylor's truck pulls up. She waits till he's finished loading and has returned to James to get his pay. Then she makes a break from the trees to the truck, leaps into the back, and disappears behind the crates and barrels.
Thank you, Mr. Piper. All right, Leo. Drive safe.
Frances pokes her head out between the tarpaulin flaps and watches the shore road speed away beneath her. She turns and grins like a dog into the sunny sea wind and lets her braids fly out behind her. The truck slows when they reach Sydney and stops in the coke ovens section of Whitney Pier. She ducks as Taylor gets out, comes round, and undoes the tarps for his first delivery. When his broad back is turned, she hops out, lightening his load by an additional 40 ounces. She waits behind a tar-smelling timber of the CN rail bridge until he drives away. Then she walks over to the run-down clapboard house and knocks at a big steel door. If I should take a notion to jump into the ocean, 'tain't nobody's business if I do, 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 do. I swear I won't call no copper if I'm beat up by my papa. 'Tain't nobody's business if I do. The roses all have left your cheek. Saturday, August 31st, 1918. Dear Diary, I don't know where to begin. I have to get it all down now while it's fresh. I'm here under my tree in Central Park, and we have all afternoon till supper time. I'll have to go back a few days because, despite all that whining about nothing ever happening, I realize now that tons was happening, and it was all leading up to what I have to tell you, which is everything. I have no shame in front of you, Diary, for you are me. You won't squirm. You can't be shocked. You know that nothing in love is nasty, so I will try to be as free with you as I am in my own thoughts. Lest I forget, let me offer up a sincere horizon of thanks for Giles. She is the least curious person on the face of the earth. Without her total lack of vigilance, my life could never have got started. If Daddy knew what a lackadaisical gatekeeper she is, he would be down here in a second to board me with the nuns. Which reminds me, I'd better write him. Oh, but I'm teasing you, aren't I, Diary? You're in an agony of anticipation. Be still. Open your heart, and I will begin at the beginning and unfold it for you as it unfolded for me. I've watched them fade away and die. Book 5, Diary of a Lost Girl. Baby Burlesque. A 6-inch panel thwacks open and 2 brown eyes take aim at her beneath a single eyebrow. Frances holds up a bottle of James's Finest. The panel slides closed, and after a moment the steel door opens. Standing there is a big man, wavy black hair, nose like a fist, arms like cannon, would-be olive skin, but he obviously doesn't see much sunlight. Young, and Frances has to figure, dopey. He stares down at her blankly, blocking the inner gloom she is so longing to glimpse.
Close the friggin' door, Boutros. It's broad fucking daylight, bye.
A small man elbows the younger one aside and, with a glance not at Frances but over her shoulder, grabs her arm.
Get in, get in!
She's in. The interior of the speakeasy lives down to its exterior. It's the only drab house in the coke ovens. Peeling gray paint, boarded windows. You'd have to know what you were looking for to find it, because it appears deserted, with the exception of the upper story, where a few tired petunias and chewed marigolds cling to life in a window box, overlooking the slag dump of Dominion iron and steel. Above is the train bridge. This is Railway Street. Frances blinks into the dusty shadows and the room takes shape. Benches line the walls. Wallpaper strips with traces of lords and ladies flap from ceiling corners, dingy with nicotine and neglect. On the floor, a genuine brass spittoon awash in brown slime, and several dusty tin cans that serve the same purpose. A pile of cigarette butts has been swept to the center of the floorboards. A makeshift bar, sheet of scrap metal on two oil drums, bottles and barrels. Not a mirror, not a shot glass. No engravings of ships or trains. No regimental photo. No boxing heroes grace the walls. In the far corner stands a scarred player piano. Frances looks into the taut, sallow face of the small man. His black stubble matches his eyes.
Who sent you? You're not selling cookies.
He snickers. Frances feels suddenly ridiculous in her girl guide uniform, which she thought was the perfect disguise. It's a costume, she falters.
You're a what?
She can't answer. Her eyebrows quiver. She's mad at herself. Baby. Suki baby, Frances. She bites her cheek and looks down.
I asked you a question.
She looks up at him. He is something new. Not a nun, not a bad boy, not her father.
Get out of here. Go on. Beat it.
He shoves her toward the door. Frances stumbles and blurts out, I'm an entertainer. He stops and laughs, hands in his pockets, a mean, mirthless laugh, his sharp tongue protruding past his lower lip as he jingles change with one hand. Beside him, Big Boutros hasn't changed his expression, still just looking at her.
Maybe going to jump me, and won't give me no quarter neither. Won't take no.
Frances looks around. But there's nowhere to run. The dumb giant is planted between her and the door. Why didn't she leave when the greasy little man told her to? Frances wants suddenly to hightail it home to Lily and Mercedes.
What's your name, kid?
Frances says, I have to go now. Sorry to bother you. The little man gestures to her to come here. Frances walks slowly back to him. He snatches the bottle from her hand. Everything about him is a coiled spring ready to pop you in the eye. Frances doesn't see him move. She's just suddenly sitting hard on her tailbone on one of the benches.
Please, mister, I just want to go home.
Come on, sweetheart. What's your name?
Frances doesn't reply. He grips her chin between thumb and forefinger. She realizes he's stronger than he looks. He shakes her head till her neck burns. She starts to relax.
You gonna be nice now? Hey? You gonna answer me?
This isn't so hard after all. Fuck off, she says. He seizes a fistful of her hair and yanks her back to her feet. Frances is elated at the power of the word, unleashed here for the first time on a grown-up. She laughs at him and spits.
Who do you think I am? Look at the bottle, stupid.
He smacks her efficiently, one eye already on the label. He examines it, lips still parted and curled. He looks back at her and shakes his head slowly. Frances straightens her beret. The man tosses the bottle to Boutros without looking and asks her,
He know you're here?
No, but he will.
Bullshit.
Francis just shrugs. He repeats,
bullshit. You tell him, he'll kill you.
He'll kill you second. You touched me.
She puts her chin up and looks down her nose.
Daddy wouldn't like that.
The man considers this. Then he says,
which one are you?
Francis.
He narrows his eyes.
What do you want, Francis?
A job.
He starts to laugh again, but Francis just looks him steady in the eye. He shuts up and asks,
what can you do?
I can dance. I can sing and play piano.
He looks her up and down.
What else?
She twists her mouth into a sneer she hopes is hard as nails.
I can do anything.
He gives a short chuckle, then another, and nods.
You're all right, Francis.
Without taking his eyes off her, he says to Boutros, say hello to your cousin, bye. Francis looks up at Boutros, concrete with eyeballs. She turns back to the small man.
What are you talking about?
I'm Jamil. I'm your uncle, doll.
That's when Francis sees, between yellow-gray curtains in the dusk of a rear doorway, a puffy woman staring at her in a way that shocks her. Only people who know me really well hate me like that. Who can she be? Then, with a sickening half-turn of her stomach, Francis identifies the other side of a coin she knew and loved so well.
Camille, come here and meet your niece, dear,
says Jamil. But Camille just turns and disappears into the back room. Francis hears her slow, heavy foot up the stairs.
It's too horrible.
Not these men. Not the brown sputum in the cans, the butts on the floor, the stench of liquor and puke. But the fact that that hateful woman is Mama's sister. The following Saturday, without waiting for James to leave on his midnight rounds, Frances gets out of bed, puts on her guide uniform, ties two sheets together, knots them, and fastens one end to the radiator. She climbs out the window and rappels down the side of the house. Lily reels the ladder back in once Frances has landed safely. Lily will sleep fitfully till just before dawn in the expectation of hearing a cinder against the window pane. In helping Francis, she has chosen the lesser of two evils. Even though it's terrible not to know where Francis will spend the long night, it is more terrible still to picture what Francis's face will look like if Daddy catches her.
Please, dear God, please let Ambrose look after Francis.
Ain't she sweet? She's a-walkin' down the street. Now I ask you very confidentially, ain't she sweet?
Well-off people purchase liquor discreetly and consume it in a civilized manner at home. Ordinary people pass the jar in a convivial kitchen. Loose pegs and young trouble-seekers come to Jamil's blind pig in the pier to fight, play cards, and pass out. Miners, merchant seamen, and steel workers, some as sweet and others as sour as soldiers. A few genuine formaldehyde drunks, the odd alienated contemplative just passing through, a vet with no visible injuries. No music. No one even cranks the old player piano. This place is not sufficiently jovial to inspire more than a caterwauling chorus at closing time.
The clientele are white with the exception of one or two of the American sailors.
Certainly no one is here from the coke ovens itself. There are no women. There are no tourists. This isn't Harlem. No slumming scions. Frances is the only fallen princess to have crossed the threshold. Her Aunt Camille doesn't count because she is not here voluntarily. She stays upstairs until it's time to come down and empty the spittoons and swab the piss from the doorstep. Francis arrives outside the steel door, takes a last breath of coke oven air, and enters the dim roar of the speak, passing under Boutros's arm as if it were a bridge. The air is palpable, not just with smoke, but with the dark mass of male voices and limbs, work-soiled clothes, the smell of axle grease, sulfur, and sweat. A shifting, pitching anchorage of hard, dirty hulls in the night, and Francis swims among them without so much as a paddle or a spar. What would be more frightening? To be noticed and netted? Or accidentally crushed? She finds Jamil and gets up the nerve to order a drink in what she hopes is the voice of experience, impatient for her first real taste of sin. Jamil tells her to forget it and get to work. She looks about. Work. No stage, no footlights. Certainly no hushed turning of heads at her approach to the piano. Where to begin? Frances wishes for a fairy godmother to swathe her in ostrich feathers, in breasts, hips, lips, and lipstick, a husky contralto which she imagines to be Louise Brooks's voice. No such luck. 5 foot nothing, flat as two bumps on an ironing board, hips like chopsticks. At 16, Frances is as grown as she'll ever be. She stands before the piano, since there's no stool. It's missing a few teeth. The rest are edged in decay. Still others are intact but silent. Its pocked and yellowed music rolls date from a long-dead turn-of-the-century parlor. Frances turns to the indifferent bass throng and feels her knees turning to water. To stop herself running away, she kicks up her heels in the fake tap dance that earned her so many pennies on the docks. No response. Not even a boo. She is invisible. A tobacco-streaked wad of mucus lands next to her shoe by chance. She gags briefly, closes her eyes, clenches her fists, and wills herself into song, belting at the top of her narrow lungs, "Mademoiselle from Amantière, parlez-vous? Mademoiselle from Amantière, parlez-vous? Mademoiselle from Amantière, she hasn't been fucked in 40 years. Inky-dinky, parlez-vous?" To no avail. What is shocking in the schoolyard passes unnoticed at the speak. She goes through her repertoire, but it's no use. Who wants to look at a skinny girl guide doing a solo secondhand foxtrot picked up from the movie screen? Never mind, listen to her spindly Cupid doll voice. Jamil doesn't. He wants her out on her ear. He grabs her neckerchief. She writhes free, and in a desperate last-ditch sally, lands on someone's knee and steals his drink. "Hey!" She downs the shot, gasps in shock. Then quips in moving picture parlance, "Oh, gee, baby, how did the angels ever let you leave heaven?" She weaves out of reach between slim hips and broad shoulders, steals another from a man with 3 jacks. "What do you think you're doing?" And knocks it back, promising, "I've got what ain't in books." Coughing, sputtering, blowing a kiss. Jamil follows with a bottle, calming the waters, signaling to Boutros, "Get rid of her." When Frances has downed her 3rd drink in quick succession from a great, big, good-looking, some-account man, and is convinced that her esophagus and chest have been burned away, her feet suddenly sprout wings. They become hap-hap-happy. She cranks the player piano. The mechanical thumping of a hobnail army renders "Coming Through the Rye," and Frances wriggles out of her uniform and down to her skivvies via the Highland Fling Coom Can Can. They start watching. On Monday, Frances skips school and heads for Satchelest Chisholm's barber shop. She shows him a picture of Louise Brooks. He shakes his head.